Recording in progress.
How did you experience the beginning of the pandemic?
You know, and this is like the early days of the pandemic when we were all sort of like, is this the apocalypse of theater as we know it? Like, is theater, is the art form completely over?
And we, you know, we all kind of felt like we need to pull together and be there for each other and trying to, you know, get through this extremely traumatizing and extremely traumatic moment in for our industry, yeah? With many people losing jobs, losing life, losing health.
Your question about theater concepts, the one that's maybe most up for grabs is the notion of the audience, because I think that we're going to, we're of course going to come together as an audience and watch theater live together. And I can't wait for that to happen.
And so we decided to do a second edition in 2020. And that's when the pandemic hit, as we were in the process of launching the festival. And then suddenly everybody was stuck at home and couldn't go to see theater. So global theater became quite important.
And the fact that we can't go physically to the theater at the moment. So to find a space to reflect on what that is that we're doing when we're going to the theater.
You know, it's maybe embarrassing to admit, because of course I love the form so much, but I have really missed the ritual, and especially the other people. I mean, that's the thing that I've been really mourning.
We thought that would be a really good idea to, because on the one hand, mourn what we can't do at the moment, but on the other hand, also develop sort of theoretical frameworks and creative ways of approaching the description of that moment, rather than focusing on the performance and what actors are doing or what happens on stage, to really focus on what is happening with the audience or with us as a spectator.
That ritual of getting together at a set time with strangers, afterwards you get to go with your friends or indeed some of those strangers to praise the show as genius or trash it as garbage or have drinks and just talk about it.
You know, it's funny, I don't know if this was the last thing I saw, but I went back and looked, you know, it having been a year over here, I went back and looked at the last thing that I had reviewed.
One of the last shows that I had seen was the revival of Young Gene Lee's We're Gonna Die.
And it was so bad that it became kind of comforting, because it was this reminder that, you know, I think that we tend to see things, you know, as sort of glowing and hazy, you know, like, oh, if we could only be back in the theater. And it was this sort of slap in the face reminder that a lot of theater is really, really terrible.
Where the audience was bombarded with balloons at the end. But there we were, joined together to see this show called We're Gonna Die. Maybe we were gonna die, but for a moment I was really joyful when those balloons came down, like the easiest trick ever, and it works every time, you know?
People who take part in our workshops were asked to write a sort of 10-minute provocation in the form of an anecdote, of a thick description, really, of what they experience when they go to the theater, and to really reflect on what are the things that they sort of need to be receptive to the event, what are the props, their personal props, like a notebook or certain things that they maybe buy in the break for a snack, certain things that make up this ritual of going to the theater.
I am going to see a show at the Deutsches Theater, the Schaubühne, the Volksbühne or the Hau with Ann-Christine, and we are talking about when to meet up. Why my inkling is leaning towards half an hour before the curtain goes up, or even earlier. Ann-Christine suggests being there 5 to 10 minutes before the show starts. I am agreeing to this time frame, knowing that I will still arrive 20 minutes early. Ann-Christine will probably show up sometime between 10 and 3 minutes before. Of course, in Berlin, that is not really a problem because no show starts on time. We meet outside. She is relaxed to go in while I am a nervous wreck, as I was fearing she could be late, which of course she never was. But what made me that nervous? Why did I feel such a disquiet?
How has your work in the arts changed due to the pandemic?
This was also the time when theaters were feeling generous and wanted to share their work suddenly globally.
Two things were happening. One is that like the intense amount of stuff that was available for streaming, you know, that artists were opening up their archives and showing other videos of past works or whatever was happening on Zoom.
So I had a history of interacting with theater through a screen and loving it and not feeling deprived. So in that sense, I went in somewhat optimistic.
I was incredibly lucky because I had a digital practice going into this. So I was offered work faster than I think people that didn't.
You know, I was doing a lot of Googling and site hopping and app hopping in that moment.
And so we did, you know, we did the festival and then it was so popular, we extended it for 2 weeks. So it ended up having over 40 shows from all over the world.
It was always open, that idea, to reflecting on the current moment of what happens when we go to the virtual theater, right? Or when we sit in our living rooms, or our bedrooms, or our beds, and watch virtual theater.
I'm at home, like you said. That's the big change in process. I used to go out to work. I did it with somewhat less frequency once I had children. I used to go to the theater 5 or 6 nights a week, and I really put a cap on it at about 3, although sometimes it would sneak up to 4. But you know, 4 times a week, I would put on reasonable clothing and I would put on lipstick and I would leave my home and I would get on the subway and I would go to a theater. I would sit as an adult among other adults and I would think and write about it. And that's gone. That's all gone.
So I was just incredibly lucky in that respect to have work. But there was a huge difficulty in terms of the people I was collaborating with, the venues I was working for, in that they didn't understand what a digital timeline, or what we were talking about, a digital process, that was very different to a theatrical process.
I mean, the biggest change in process is that it's location-based. I don't leave my home, and any theater that I encounter at home.
In this age of online productions that you can kind of pause or watch when you want, I felt sort of irritated because
my attention is compromised. Like, we're here, I'm at home, I can like watch 20 minutes of this and then shut my computer and go get a snack and then come back and maybe do some emails and then come back and watch 10 more minutes and I'm kind of distracted. And
working on Zoom is a nightmare for any long period of time.
The device of the computer is such a pitfall, right? It's like the same machine where you like write your messages, do your banking, do your shopping, do your grocery shopping during the pandemic.
And you're really split from your team and from your support network.
The limitation of feeling bodiless was really hard.
I mean, we ended up working hideous hours and having a really difficult time in a way that actually couldn't have happened if we were in even offices together.
And those slow revelations of how time was going to sort of stretch like taffy.
Or, you know, in a venue, but we were stuck in our bedrooms on Zoom till like 1 a.m. trying to fix stuff.
Just to speak on the sort of producing side of it, one of the things that became really exciting about this piece is that it has changed our relationship to some of our presenting partners, how we work with a theater.
The thing that worries me is the continued exploitation of artists. People aren't really getting paid more to do these digital versions. And then obviously, you know, you get a fee for, you have to turn up every day for your 2-week run and you get paid for that. Whereas I can see, and I'm starting to see a situation where you're like, oh, well, you just need to record it once, but then we'll play it for as long as we want.
The thing about putting on 1,000 ways is that we aren't actually needed to be anywhere. There's nothing for us to fly in and do. It either all happens by the computer or for part two, it's like we send you the cards and we teach you how to install it. It's much more like an installation in a way.
And that feels dangerous, but I think we can borrow from the film sector a bit more emphatically and in terms of thinking about like, okay, your distribution rights, you can only show it this many times here.
We're further behind you in Berlin, I think, for many reasons that we can get into, but in part because we don't have a state subsidized theater industry, things just stopped and people had to do other things, of course, to pay their bills.
The way the arts is actually subsidized is through often the hospitality sector. So your actors and your directors, everyone's working in a cafe or everyone's working in a bar.
There's a whole generation of young theater makers that are just going to be driven out or will choose to move on. So there's this irony that just as for various other reasons, we want more and more plural voices in the theater and to hear about the experience of different kinds of people who've been historically shut out of the theater industry.
Yeah, so I have questions about the financial model about it, but I do think it's a really useful and exciting thing to have the live and the streamed version hand in hand.
My fear is that in spite of that, the channel is narrowing, and you know, theater making for people in the US, for young theater makers, is going to be the domain, more than ever, the domain of the financially independent, if you will.
You know, in the United States, it is not just COVID and funding. It is deeply embedded with and enmeshed with our questions of social justice and racial justice and economic justice in our country right now.
Yeah, I think there's just not been anywhere near enough support. I know lots of people that just kind of gave up. Loads of people I know ended up have applied to do other courses, are retraining in different areas. And I think all that's actually going to happen is we're going to be left with an even smaller group of people that can make theatre. And I think that's really, really sad.
What is digital liveness for you?
The theater which we have seen develop during the pandemic is a kind of on the border between, you know, intermediality or multimediality, digital theater and transmedia theater. And it's oftentimes, you know, sort of difficult to classify. Is Zoom, live Zoom interactive performance transmedia? Is it intermedia? Is it multimedia? Like, how do we classify it?
What are the things that could only be done digitally? And so I started looking at advances that were happening sort of on the scrappier edges of theater. So things like immersive theater and audio only theater and escape rooms. And that was actually where I found a lot of satisfaction.
The entire project is delivered to you through multiple venues. So this means that it can be partially live performance, partially social media, partially you can maybe get a phone call or maybe text message, or maybe there is an interactive component, maybe there is a live component, maybe there is a podcast component for you to get the full picture. You have to be engaged with all of those components.
So in the beginning, the first lockdown, the Munich Kammerspiele, they were doing lots of stuff like just suddenly on Zoom without any preparation. So naive in a way and so raw in a way that I found very interesting. Actors in front of the camera acting they would do on stage, but at the same time seeing how they try to adjust to what is happening because it's Zoom and will it work out or won't it work out?
But I very quickly realized that stuff that was being made for the camera, theater that was being made for the camera, particularly theater that was being pre-recorded rather than live captured, was just kind of agonizing. I think because
I don't feel like much theater has really benefited from being forced onto a screen. And it has helped me understand how, at the end of the day, video on stage works really well in the before times. Without live performers to juxtapose to the filmed ones, a kind of key tension seemed to be missing for me from most online theater to its detriment.
Because watching it became a kind of act of mourning or an act of substitution. Because you were seeing it and trying to imagine, okay, what would this be like if I were sitting in an actual theater with actual people and actual actors in the same space at the same time? And it's not that, and it can't be that. And so it just can make you feel very itchy and very impatient.
My favorite performances have been the ones that begin at a set time and run through.
One of the things I adore about the form of theater is the fact that you could miss it, that you have to be there.
Yeah, I think for me, liveness has much more to do with risk.
You know, like you had to be in the room and there's that thing of like, oh, did you miss that show? Well, you'll never know. I'll tell you about it, but you actually had to be there.
I remember seeing a Split Britches show and feeling the entire way through that this performance could collapse.
We are always interested in liveness as a sort of texture and as a concept. How is this and why is this, why does this piece need to happen in a live way? Why is it not something that exists in a vacuum or in a static form?
It has to be somewhat live, but it has to give us a reason to be live.
Part of the dramaturgy of the work was it was about Peggy's memory and not quite being able to remember the lines maybe. So you're always aware that Peggy might genuinely just forget the next line, or like the show might have to stop. And I think that kind of hits on what liveness is for me. This idea that any moment something could happen to throw things off, something might go wrong.
We not yet fully grasp how to work in that environment, which is somewhat controlled, but not completely controlled. And so I think the artists are trying to still figure out how to create the borderlines, the framework of control in environments like that. And that's going to be a challenge for a while.
You know, I probably sound really conservative, but what makes theater amazing to me is precisely that it's not television.
The tools that you are using are very different than just straight filmmaking or television shows, which operate on a kind of a quick shifting storytelling that grabs your attention.
I really looked for the stuff that demanded something of me beyond ordinary attention, some kind of participation, because that helped with focus, and also for the shows that could not have been made live.
What are the potential and challenges of digital theater?
With the online shows, it's a little bit more challenging because, you know, it's very easy to just turn off your computer. And so you really have to work at keeping people's attention and keeping them involved and making them feel that they are part of a live experience. And that's, you know, quite difficult to accomplish.
Which brings me to the exception you asked me about. One show that I thought really tried to generate that tension, and that really maybe began from the premise of asking what's newly possible that wasn't possible before.
A revelation I had was a couple of months in. It was 5 a.m. because this was a UK show and this was the only time I could do it. So I was in absolute dark in our apartment, trying not to wake anyone up, you know, whispering, you know, into my laptop.
Was a show out of New York called Circle Jerk. The first 2/3 of that show in particular, I really loved, in part because the design was so good. It was like the best design I saw in a mile in virtual theater. And because the design was so good, the show could kind of compete with crazy kind of video art that it was sometimes recalling.
And it was a multi-screen show. So as you engaged on a kind of Zoom call with actors and with other participants, and the participants had been cast as a jury, you were also receiving information via email and text. And so it was a multi-screen performance, and it couldn't have existed in a theater.
But it also retained that kind of manic energy of live theater because you had 3 actors playing multiple roles. And sometimes they had scenes, you know, 2 of their characters had scenes with themselves. Because they were doing it live, it had this kind of antic charge that really worked with the material that I loved.
And it was so exciting because it was the first piece I saw that really felt like it was made in response to what our lives are now, these kind of multi-screen lives.
And the beautifully designed space was essentially a series of sound stages which were connected, beautifully realized, so that when they were in this or that set, there was really a beautiful picture for you. But we could also periodically see the actors darting from one of those sets to the other, trying to make that 10 feet while getting the new wig on or getting that article of clothing off. And that generated that kind of tension between live and recorded.
And it was exciting. It was fun. We actually had this really exciting ending where we figured something out in the last moment. So it became this, it was so dramatic. And I loved it. And I thought, okay, I can do this.
All of our pieces really rely on the presence of a spectator, that we can't do this in a vacuum, that the people on stage need to be being watched in order to complete the equation of the performance. And so in the case of 1,000 Ways, there are no external spectators and there are no actors. The only people engaged in the performance are the attendees who make it happen.
I want someone to have to be there and then to experience the work, because on another day it might look different.
The strange pleasure of these productions that allow people to comment on them, mm-hmm. which I found strangely comforting, that reminder that you're watching with a whole bunch of other people talking about it on the right side of the screen. If you told me about it before I'd experienced it, I'd say that's absolutely nothing I want a part of. You know, I want to make sure that I can disable that screen on my computer or whatever.
To say that you cannot record it and watch it later, but that when you do watch it together with others, you can feel the need and the urgency for the togetherness.
And that can be as simple as on another day, the way you get into the VR might be slightly different. It might feel different.
That you two end up performing this private piece of theater just for one another, with the other person and by the other person and for the other person.
Because it was a reminder of the community that came together to see this show, I really appreciated it.
This group of people find a way forward together to make a performance for and by themselves that really is about the sort of figuring out how to come together again after the emphasis being on isolation and separation.
But I would agree that there's a sense of like the people around you, there's the person giving you the headset, like the journey of onboarding, what does that look like? That's all part of the liveness for me in the journey.
I've appreciated some of the new tricks that theater makers have been forced to learn as they've gone online.
It cannot be a film, it cannot be a stream event, it has to be something else. It has to find its own niche and its own form.
I think that something we're always interested in all of our works is a hyper presence. And so the telephone just somehow felt like that would be like the really awesome tool. If this piece is connecting two people together who don't know each other and they're going to do this thing one-on-one, it would be great to use the telephone's magic in that way.
I think my first sort of moment of real creative joy with VR was thinking about a queer dramaturgy that could be applied to it. And for me, there's this idea in VR that you're always missing something, right? There's always something behind you.
The transportive magical quality of a phone call where you can't use your eyes to see the other person, which means that you're actually hyper present in your space.
So this idea that there's something always behind you that you're missing, and that's okay. It just needs to be highlighted and recognized.
I am looking at my space. I'm looking at my hand. I'm looking at the floor. I'm noticing the fly that's in the window. I'm noticing like the crack in the floor. I'm really attuned to the space and also at the same time able to be hyper present with the person I'm speaking with.
In a transmedia interactive works, which you know, a lot of these have been done in last year in particular, where there is a live component and the performers are interacting with the audience members, you know, that the clarity of, you know, the kind of aliveness of the event.
Feeling of like, I need you to do this with me and you need me and we're not going to do it perfectly, but it's definitely not going to happen if we don't commit.
Theater provides a unique insight into human condition that maybe television and film don't necessarily have, you know, provide the same kind of experience, the same kind of discourse that theater has a history of providing. And so rather than trying to reject those new technologies, we should seriously think through them.
Actually, I don't know who you are, but I'm going to metaphorically hold your hand through this so that we can have something, some experience together.
Digital theater, transmedia theater has a real potential to show us how our new virtual reality is structured and how it influences our, you know, physical reality, how those narratives interact with the actual events, you know, actual things taking place in real life.
What does the future of theater look like?
Basically, the idea was that we will ask theater artists to share their work for, you know, one day or a couple hours with the global audiences, to provide free access to people who don't have a possibility of, you know, going to see a show.
When I had a discussion with students about how they felt digital theater was, you know, what was it for them? One of them, who was kind of always sort of fighting her own kind of chronic pain sort of syndrome and having a sort of physical disability, was saying, well, actually, I think it's great because it's taking us away from an ableist discourse. It's taking us away from, oh, you have to get into that theater, especially in the UK, where a lot of theaters are in like old buildings, or, you know, the festival in Edinburgh is really hard access wise.
It wasn't part of the concept. It just was a sort of beautiful thing that came as a result of the piece, was that, oh, all of a sudden, which is such an obvious thing now to think about, but you can attend from anywhere, right? So when the show ran from the public theater, callers were coming from all over the world.
And now it seems to be kind of obvious, yeah? But at the time when we launched, this was a pretty radical idea because all of the online portals have been very nationally focused.
She said, well, it's great because now they have to subtitle everything and now they have to, you know, make it available and I can just watch it even though I might not be able to walk, I can still partake in theater. And that really brought it home for me as well. You know, our idea of what we want to go back to as normal. Yes, Sasha and I agree. It's great to walk out of the seminar room together, but what about those people who can't walk out of the seminar room for whatever reason, you know?
And there was very little interaction between theater artists from different countries and theater critics from different countries.
And so what it meant to present a work was really exciting. All of a sudden our audience expanded in this spider web of a way, in a way that I won't even really know, because it's not like I see all the attendance reports or anything. So I don't know who was calling from where.
On top of it, it was mostly driven by Western academics and theater scholars. Yeah. And they would be the ones who would travel somewhere and would report on different performances, you know, happening in Asia and Africa and South America and all of that.
And same in any of the shows, you know, we've had callers from China, from Australia, from Pakistan, from Abu Dhabi, from Mexico, from Romania, like wildly, wildly divergent places on the map. But of course, all you need is the call-in number.
To really think about these structural changes to how we deliver teaching, but also how theaters create aesthetic experiences, to make that possible for us to, mingle with people who may be not able to get there.
And it also breaks a little bit the economic and other divides.
You know, these structural changes, I really hope that there will be some sustained learning in that area to make that more accessible.
You know, there is a huge, huge audience out there that want to engage with us, but this doesn't have the same means and possibilities to participate.
And that there are certain lessons learned from having to pivot to the digital temporarily, and to make that into a permanent fixture. That would be great.
But nonetheless, there is a place for theater if theater is willing to go there and figure out what's unique about our history and, you know, kind of a global legacy that theater has through various cultural traditions. Can we kind of find a unique new language that can embrace both tradition and the history and the global legacy of the theater with the new technologies?
My hope is that it becomes just as experimental and radical as like certain aspects of theater have, certain parts of theater have been allowed to be.
In a best case scenario, I would hope that on the part of, like, let's say theater studies, thinking about digital theater, thinking about the changes that the current pandemic makes to our work routines, to how we use technology, we were hoping that maybe there is a more of an awareness that we need sort of more knowledge and expertise in understanding these technologies that theaters and companies and artists are now employing. You know, we need to know more about algorithms, we need to know more about data sets and data protection laws and you know, all of these, you know, things that maybe are not aesthetic considerations, but they are part and parcel of studying the phenomenon.
So I think that we are on the cusp of reimagining and rethinking and creating that kind of new art form.
And that people really invest and trust artists that we know what we're doing, or equally trust us that we don't know what we're doing, but we'll make something really interesting by the end of it.
But it's also true that the new digital audience is not going to go away. I think, you know, this is now going to be a part of the genre. And it will be a matter for theater makers to determine how they serve these two very different audiences.
I think, I hope the sort of experimental risk-taking aspect of theater can be applied when you're making mixed reality or digital work as well.
I think this is a really exciting year because we're watching a theater to try to figure out what it is and how it's going to differentiate itself from all of those different other entertainment modes and forms.
Which will be a real challenge, but every time there's a challenge, every time in theater history there's a great new technological challenge, it's afforded a whole bunch of other opportunities.
That's my hope. Where I think it will go is sort of, yeah, what you were saying earlier about the hybrid models. I think we'll be live streaming, or not necessarily live streaming, but we'll be streaming and we'll be in live scenarios. And I think that's a really good combo. I think that's really, really positive.
Theater's kind of crude in that way. Like, we're just people in a room making some magic tricks happen. So how does the work, if it's presented digitally, how does it still capture that feeling of like, oh, we're just figuring this out? You know, the humbleness of what theater is as a form.
And an interesting, I don't know, I just think it's really interesting to think that in like 50 years, someone will be like, oh yeah, but aren't you doing a stream of it as well? And we'll be like, oh, well, we actually didn't always used to do streams. It was only because there was this thing, it was called the coronavirus pandemic. You weren't born then. prior to that, nobody would ever live stream a theatre apart from the National into a cinema once a year. So I think that's quite cool.